The Bain Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, music, maulers, and manslaughter, all in operatic proportions. Does the fat lady sing for thee? Plus Templars with machine guns and angry Avengers with shiny, shiny swords on a mass market rampage. And part 29 of the complete audiobook serialization of David Weber's Shadow of Freedom. All right now. Welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bain editor Tony Daniel. Coming up, we have an interview with Eric Flint and David Carrico, the co-authors of a new entry in the Ring of Fire alternate history series. It's called 1636, The Devil's Opera. This is an interesting Ring of Fire novel set in the city of Magdeburg. It's a murder mystery and has a really cool team of detectives. One is an uptimer from our time period or around our time period, and one is a downtimer from 1636 in Europe. Eric and David have lots to say about all this, so keep the bites flowing for that. And of course, we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of David Weber's Shadow of Freedom. But first, join me for the news. October is chock full of new Bain releases, and we'll be talking about all of those this month, but we wanted to mention the new mass market paperbacks out this month and at booksellers everywhere. Now, mass markets are those regular size paperbacks, not the trade paperbacks, which are the ones that are the same size as hardcovers. Anyway, there are two new mass market paperbacks in October. The first of these is Phoenix Rising by Reich E. Spohr. This is the first book in an epic fantasy series, which I think we're going to call the Balanced Sword Saga. I think that's what Reich's calling it. Reich is busy writing books 2 and 3 even as we speak. Phoenix Rising has some great characters in it, one of which is not like any you may have seen before in a fantasy series. I don't want to give you a spoiler, but his name is Poplock, and you'll just have to read the book to find out what he is. The main character is Kiri, who is a young woman forced into a warrior's role after nefarious forces destroy her family. She's a very winning heroine, and the book is excellent epic fantasy. Also in October is a brand new, never-before-published novel that we're putting out in mass-market paperback form. We call these mass-market originals, and Bain has a long tradition of publishing books that the format fits. This is one of those. It's called Swords of Exodus, and it is by Larry Correa and Mike Capari. Larry is, of course, the creator of the Monsterverse series, which also started out as a Bain mass market original, by the way. And Mike is active duty military who has only recently returned from serving in Afghanistan. With these guys at the helm, you can be pretty sure that this military adventure novel is going to be great, and it is. I've read it, of course. It's also lots of fun if you like blood-soaked journeys through a bunch of cool secret history, like a reimagined modern-day Templars organization, for example. I really recommend this one if you happen to enjoy pulse-pounding, hard-driving action novels, and I'll bet you do. So, Swords of Exodus and Phoenix Rising are out as mass-market paperbacks and available now at booksellers everywhere. I'm joined by editor emeritus Hank Davis, and we're pleased to welcome Eric Flint and David Carrico to the podcast. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey there.
Eric Flint is no stranger to the podcast. He is a multiple New York Times bestseller and is unarguably, I think at this point, the best-selling alternate history writer around these days, or any other days maybe. Eric is best known for his Ring of Fire series, beginning with 1632 in the actual year 2000 is when it came out. I think that's right. The stories revolve around a West Virginia mining town, Grantville, that is thrown back in time and into the midst of Europe in the year 1632. Eric is also known for his Belisarius series and many others, including many science fiction novels.
Before he became a full-time writer, Eric was a longtime labor union activist and has a master's degree in history. We have what I think is a dandy interview with Eric about his background and his writing in our very first Bain Free Radio Hour podcast. And I'd really encourage you to check that out, listeners. And David Carrico once threw a book of fiction across the room and declared, "I can do better than that." And after working a bit at the craft, he began to publish on a regular basis, thus affirming his own premise. Many of his first publications were through his involvement with the 1632.org site with its Grantville Gazette, which is an ongoing anthology of stories set in Eric Flint's Ring of Fire alternate history setting. David has a degree in music theory and composition, and music often plays a role in his stories, including the new novel that we're here to talk about, 1636, The Devil's Opera. 1636, The Devil's Opera is just out from Bain now in October. It's a hardcover at booksellers everywhere, and I think it's the 14th full novel in the Ring of Fire series. Is it 14? Do we know?
It's not quite the whole one. It's 12 or 13. People often think Ram Rebellion's a novel. It's not technically, but I actually can tell you in a minute. But anyway, keep going. Let's see. Wait a minute. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Actually, it is the 13th. Yeah. Okay.
If you don't count Ram Rebellion.
Ram Rebellion usually gets counted as a novel, but it's really, you could call it a braided novel. It's kind of it's an anthology technically because a bunch of stories by different authors, but all the stories are related to each other and they all follow a common story arc. So in that sense, it's structured like a novel.
Well, let's go back to number one. Eric, did you ever think that nearly, like 15 years ago almost now, when you wrote the first of the Ring of Fire books, that the series would have touched so many people, given so many writers a start? So can you tell us a little bit about how this juggernaut got going?
Well, no, I didn't have any idea at all, because I wrote 1632 as a standalone novel. I didn't really have any intention of turning it into a series. That happened because after the book came out, it was quite popular. And to be honest, Jim Bain waved quite a bit of money at me. And to paraphrase Samuel Johnson, the prospect of making a lot of money concentrates the mind wonderfully. So I thought about it. I was leery of turning into a series because I've seen. There are a lot of bad series out there where the first book is good, but there's really not enough of a basis for a really long-running story. But you can always add stories because you can always think up a plot, but it doesn't mean that it's particularly about anything. And I finally decided I could make 1632 work as a series, but I'd have to make it completely open-ended in the sense that there wouldn't be any end in mind. It would just be, let the logic of that situation unfold and see what might happen with it. And that's how we've done it ever since. It's a large part of the reason I bring in so many other people is to keep myself from getting fixed in any preconceived rut as to how the story would go.
Well, I'm sure that they're helpful to you, but on the other hand, I can't think of any other writers that open up their world to so much.
Here's the thing. I would, we can do it with 1632 for a specific reason that doesn't apply to most other novels, and that is that so much of that story has an objective framework that I did not create. The first is the actual history of the 17th century. I did not create the year 1632. I did not create Cardinal Richelieu. I did not create Oliver Cromwell. I did not create the 30 Years' War. These are real. Anybody can read a history book and find out about them. And I did not create exactly the town of Grantville. I did in one sense, but it's modeled very, very closely after the real town of Mannington. The point being, I didn't create the technology either. The point to that is that there's an objective framework that lots of writers can work in that series and can all work in without me having to decide everything. Now, try to imagine what it would be like for David Weber if he were to try to do the same thing in the Honor Harrington series.
where he's got. He invented the whole thing. Nobody could write any story without David having to say yes, no, or maybe to every single little thing. I co-author novels with David. I'm the only one actually in the Modern Harrington series who writes novels other than him. And I can tell you, even somebody like me who's worked with him closely, knows the setting very well, and I've written 40 novels of my own. It's difficult working in someone else's universe. Well, they've created the whole thing. And there's been any number of times I've written things that David will say, no, that won't work because, and then, something that I had no idea of. So I would not, for instance, try to do the same thing in other universes that I've worked in, like the Belisarius universe. It'd just be too hard. But it works in the 1632 universe because there's enough of an objective framework that doesn't depend on me that I do have to occasionally make decisions, but they're fairly few, and they're mainly just sort of, call them big policy decisions if you want to. I know which way the French Civil War is going to go. So if somebody wants to write a story that goes counter to that, I can say, no, you can't. But I don't have to tell them, who the King of France is, because that's established in history books.
Yeah. Well, David, can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to work with Eric and your own development as a writer? How did you first get started, and how did you begin writing stories for the Ring of Fire set in that setting?
Well, the cliche really did happen. I did throw a book across the room and say I can write better than that. It took me a while to find out it was a little harder than it looked. But I sold my first story to Eric in 2004, and that really qualified as my first professional sale. And I've sold several stories to Eric in the Ring of Fire series. I began writing stories in the Ring of Fire series because I'm an alternate history junkie. I discovered alternate history with Andre Norton's Quest Crosstime novels, with L. Sprague de Camp's wonderful novel that the title has totally dropped out.
Less Darkness Fall.
Yeah.
You're thinking of Less Darkness Fall.
Yes, that one. And H. Beam Piper's Lord Calvin of Other Winds. Horrible title, but really a pretty cool book. Those hooked me on alternate history. So I'm a junkie. I will read anybody's alternate history. And when 1632 came out, I loved it. I did not jump onto the Baines Bar bandwagon right away. I didn't find out about Grantville Gazette until the paperback of Grantville Gazette 1 came out. And that's when I found out about it, and I finished reading that, and the thought crossed my mind, these guys have had almost 400 years of musical development dropped in their lap. What are they going to react to? I mean, how are they going to deal with this? And that opened the floodgates, and I started conceptualizing music characters and writing stories about them, and the rest is history, so to speak.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about how did you two decide that, how did the book itself, the novel 1636, The Devil's Opera, come about? How did you two decide that the possibility of a collaboration on a complete novel existed for this?
David, do you remember exactly how it got started? Because I can sort of roughly guess, but I don't remember. Do you?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It was one of those surprising moments where I had been writing for 3 or 4 years, and I had joined the Grantville Gazette editorial board, and after a little while, you just announced that you and I ought to do a book together.
Okay.
And you pitched it to Jim Bain as something called 1635 Symphony for the Devil, and it was supposed to take some of the stories I had already written, and you would add some stories to it, and it would be kind of, sort of, maybe like Ram Rebellion.
Okay.
Well, about a year later, you decided that was more work than it was worth, and we would just write a novel. You said it would be easier. So we sat down and talked about it, and you said, let's write it based on the characters you've got. And I had the stories going with Franz and Marla and the music, and I also had the stories going with Byron and Gotthilf for the detectives. So we just threw them all into the pot and waited for it to ferment, and what came out was Devil's Opera.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's kind of pretty sort of what I remembered. I just couldn't remember the sequence in which things happened. I kind of keep an eye out for... I did sort of the same thing with Gorg Hoff and Paula Goodlett. They had been writing a set of serialized stories in the magazine called Butterflies in the Kremlin, which was the story of a young American who wound up going to Russia right after the Ring of Fire. And after they'd written quite a several number of them, I read them all through one sitting, and I called Paula up and I said, stop. I said, I want you to discontinue this in the magazine because there's actually a novel here. If we rework it, we have to make some changes. Basically, had to make the central character. The serial is more comic than anything else. We had to make it more serious and had to make it work as a novel. And David had written a lot of stories. Initially, all focused on his group of musicians, the uptime woman, Marla Linder, and then a number of downtime musicians she becomes affiliated with, winds up marrying one of them. Then he started writing these detective stories involving one uptime and one downtime detective who were partners. And what triggered off my interest, actually, was that, and I'm not quite sure why I did this or what the initial thought was, but early on in the series, I made Magdeburg the new capital of this new country that's emerging in Central Europe, which is basically Germany, but they call it the United States of Europe. And Magdeburg's the capital city, and it figures in a lot of stories by now, but we've never really clearly established the city. And it occurred to me that we could do a novel that did that and make it a murder mystery at the same time and then use all of David's characters as sort of would provide us an automatic backstory. Then we'd need something else to make a novel, which became the key category. The key characters who make that novel work are the young boy Simon and his friend Hans Metzger and Hans's sister Ursula, who were not in any of David's previous stories. But we already had the backstory. The city itself is kind of a character in the novel. And as part of the novel, people will see, I don't think, or I can't remember, David, I don't, they're not in your stories, but they'll be in the novel. We have actually now really well-developed maps of Magdeburg, so people can actually see the capital city. And that was kind of my initial thought, was that this would be a good story to put Magdeburg on the fictional map, so to speak. And then what it winds up being is it runs parallel to the novel I wrote just a short while ago called The Saxon Uprising. It takes place exactly the same time. In fact, there are a lot of references in Devil's Opera to events that are happening in Saxon Uprising, including the arrival of the princess and Prince Ulrich of Denmark in Magdeburg and all the rest of it. So the two books sort of interweave each other quite a bit. But that's kind of, there's a very close connection in this series, which is actually also very unusual for a series. In fact, I think this is just as unique as anything else about 1632 series, in that almost half the fiction in it is short fiction, which is very unusual for series. Series are usually just basically novels and maybe some anthologies with some short, you know, shorter fiction, but short fiction plays an integral role in the 1632 series, especially if you include the magazine as part of it. So the novel kind of grew up that way, organically, if you will.
I think that the 1632 universe is a unique thing. I have not seen, I don't even know anything that's like the kind of participation in the various ways. I mean, maybe Star Trek, but you know, it's completely different in its way.
Outside of media tie-in, which have a whole different dynamic because there's somebody who really does control that, whereas I tend to conduct this series. I do control some parts of it, but I'm not as tight-fisted, so to speak, as that. The only other thing in science fiction that is comparable is probably Marion Zimmer Bradley's Dark Over series. For a while, she had a magazine, and she was soliciting short stories from fans. But it was never as extensive, it was never as elaborate, and she kept much tighter control over it than I tried to. So the input of the other writers wasn't as major. And then she ended it eventually because there was a new conflict came up. But that's about it. That's the only thing I can think of. I discussed this once with David Drake, and the only thing he and I could come up with that was even roughly analogous, and it's not really that close.
Yeah. Well, back to the novel, Magda Bird is a huge part of this. I mean, it's the setting for this novel. This is an urban novel. It's a hard-boiled. It's got a hard-boiled plot line, and it's got a political plot line, and they both really weave together in very interesting and complicated and cool ways. Can you bring us up to speed on where we are in sort of the overall history of where are we in the 1632 timeline at this point? What's going on in USE, and how does Magda Bird relate to it in a like a political and social context to begin with?
David, you want to answer that or you want me to?
Go for it.
Okay. The novel takes place the first half of 1636. It's contemporaneous with the novel, the events in the novel, 1636, the Saxon Uprising, which I wrote. And basically what that novel was about is the civil war that explodes in the United States of Europe after the events that are portrayed in the preceding novel, which is 1635, the Eastern Front, and at the end of which Gustavus Adolphus, the emperor, suffers an injury in battle that basically leaves his brains addled, and he remains that way for months. And his chancellor of Sweden, who was in real history his right-hand man, Axel Oxenstierna, basically stages a coup d'etat. And Oxenstierna was very devoted to aristocratic principles of rule, and he was not at all happy with the changes that were happening in the Germanies as a result of the alliance between Gustavus Adolphus and the Americans who came through the Ring of Fire. So he essentially launches a counter-revolution designed to crush the whole thing, and he can do it because Gustavus Adolphus is just out of the picture. As long as he was there, it wasn't possible because he didn't have that kind of confrontational attitude toward the Americans, but Oxenstierna does. So he launches a coup d'etat, and it pivots mostly around the siege of Dresden by one of the armies under the control of the Swedes, which is the army of Bonner, who comes up from what's called the Oberpfalz. And at the end of the book, Mike Stearns brings his army. He's now a general. He's no longer the prime minister, and he comes up from Bohemia, and there's a big battle fought outside of Dresden. He relieves the siege of Dresden. And then the emperor wakes up from his coma, Oxenstierna winds up getting killed, and that's the end of the Civil War. This new book, The Devil's Opera, takes place during that entire same time period. And the backdrop in the novel is this unfolding political development. So you keep hearing and seeing it in the background. And the musical part of it is that Marla Linder decides, well, two things. One, they're going to stage an opera just to make Magda Bird. It's important to keep the capital city. One of the things Oxenstierna is trying to do is move the capital to Berlin, which in those days was a little dinky provincial capital. It wasn't the city it is today. And so part of keeping Magda Bird as the real capital of the United States of Europe is, among other things, they decided they're going to do this big opera just to show the city still alive and vibrant and so forth. And Marla makes a decision to do a recording herself of the song Let the People Sing, which becomes a kind of important political statement. And in that situation, you have the arrival, which is depicted in the other novel, Saxon Uprising, but now you're seeing it from a different viewpoint, the arrival in the city of Gustavus Adolphus' daughter, Christina, who's the future empress of of the United States of Europe and her consort, Prince Ulrich of Denmark. And they arrive in the city, and that's sort of the backdrop, the political backdrop to what happens. Now, the center of the actual story is a murder mystery. So it's a murder mystery rolled within a civil war that you're seeing a bit at a distance, because the civil war never actually comes into Magdeburg. It never gets that far, but it's always there in the background. So it's kind of a complicated story that way. And the trick for us to pull it off was to make the murder mystery work. And this is the first time I've ever written a murder mystery. First time David ever had. So that was the trick, I think, for me at least, that was the trickiest part of the book, was getting that to work right, which took some doing and some rethinking and some rewriting along the way. But we were pleased with the end result. But so there is a real murder mystery inside this whole other thing. But there's at least two or three layers in which the novels take place. But it's contemporaneous with, you could think of it as a parallel novel to Saxon Uprising.
Well, the murder mystery gives you a wonderful chance to introduce these. I think the heart of the book is the two characters, Hans and Simon. Simon Baer and Baya and Hans Metzger, who are just wonderful. It's a wonderful storyline. Can we talk about, let's talk about the music a little bit more before we get into them, because I'd like to really talk about those guys. So opera was not invented in 1636, was it, David? Why would Martha Linder and the others want to introduce it to this particular form? Why not, you know, grunge or hip hop or?
Not quite right that opera was invented, but it had been. The earliest things that musicologists call opera happened in the late 1620s. Monteverdi in Italy had written one, and Heinrich Schütz in Germany had written one. Opera, in the sense that we think of it as big opera hall, hours long production, scenery, costumes, the fat lady singing. No, that kind of opera did not exist. But the whole concept of opera and the whole concept of stage musical theater is an entrancing thing for musicians. Like I said, somewhere in one of the blurbs, musicians live for the next new sound. Well, the whole concept of musical theater, whether you think of it as opera, whether you think of it as Broadway, that's to them, it's all going to be variations on the same thing. And that whole concept is going to grab musical imagination. It's going to grab composers and performers, and they're going to want to take that and do their own visualizations of it. And that's what the opera Arthur Rex is about. I mean, the ulterior motive for doing it is, as Eric said, to draw attention to the capital and to at least sort of refer to the issues with Gustavus Adolphus. But the musicians are in it to do something new and wonderful and spectacular, and that's what, from their standpoint, that's what it's all about.
This is sort of staged as a reaction against this aristocratic Prime Minister Oxyerna. Is that his name? How you say it?
Oxyerna, as far as I know, yeah.
Yeah. So it has that context. And also, what about that other song that Eric mentioned before? Should we say where it comes from, or is it a song from here, Uptime?
It's an Uptime song. It's, you know, anybody that's heard it probably knows that it comes from the musical Les Miserables, especially since the movie came out last year. That I pulled that song in simply because, you know, I knew that Marlon had a reason to react against what Oxenstierna was trying to do. And she's a musician. She's going to think in musical terms, and that song would express what she wanted to say better than anything else I could think of. And it has the advantage to it that it is so memorable. You hear that song one time, you know it. You walk away humming it. It sticks in your ear. And that turned into a plot device.
Mm-hmm. That's the To the Barricades song, right, from Les Miserables, when they're about to confront the government.
Yeah. I can see a parade of committees of correspondence men. I could see 150 correspondence men marching down the street in procession, singing that song, and it would be incredibly impactive. But that it would come about because she sang it first.
Well, and Martha Linder is our main musical protagonist in the novel. She's quite a firebrand. Now, she's an uptimer, correct?
Right.
Yeah, and yet she's involved herself in the heart of the politics and the art of this new world that she's fallen into. Where have we seen her before in the series?
She was one of the two characters that were the core of my very first story. And I've written a bunch of stories about Marla and the guy she eventually married, Franz Sylvester. Most of those stories are in the new ebook, 1635 Music and Murder. So their whole backstory is in that book. She is an incredibly talented woman and was on the verge of graduating from high school and going to a conservatory grade musical school when the Ring of Fire happened, and that future got cut out from under her. And this is how she's adapting. She has, Mary Simpson has kind of taken her on as a protege and has brought her to Magdeburg, and Marla is doing everything she can to make music develop into something she can be a star in.
Yeah, so she's the future that she lost, she's sort of has a drive to enact here where she is now. And she's quite the mover and shaker. She's a great character. It's Marla. I'm sorry I said it wrong before. I should know that since there's a Marla in the office here who's long been involved with Bane. Well, let's switch gears for a moment and get to the murder mystery. You provide a very nasty villain and a nice mystery to solve, but it all revolves around these two sets of characters, Gotthilf Hulk and Brian Chesky, I guess we'd say it, and
Byron.
Byron. Oh, Byron. Chesky, yeah. Oh, it's Byron Chesky.
Byron, not Brian.
Marla, Brian, Byron. Okay. Sure.
Me Tarzan, you Jade.
All right. And those magnificent two characters. I really like this thread in the story. Simon Baia and Hans Metze. Also, my son is named Hans, so I'm not going to get that one wrong. Let's talk about Gotthilf and Chieske. This is Hawk and Chieske. This is a wonderful partnership, and surely you've written more stories about them. Are they in the ebook that we're also offering, David?
Yeah, there's three stories that were published in the Grantville Gazette that were also pulled into 1635 Music and Murder. So all of the backstory of both the music characters and the detectives is in this ebook. So it's all there. So the ebook basically is a prequel to the novel.
And what's the title of it again?
1635 Music and Murder.
Okay, so we could, if you like these guys, you can go back and check them out, their origins, or you can read their origins and then read The Devil's Opera. Well, tell us a little. This is a great idea, combining an uptime and a downtime cop as a team. And it seems like a sort of unique to the Ring of Fire universe kind of thing. Who are these guys, and why do they want to be cops? What is Byron like and Gotthilf Hulk?
Byron is... he has a little bit of police background from the uptime. He had been a patrolman for one of the cities and was actually trying to get on with the West Virginia State Police when the Ring of Fire happened. So he has a little background with it. Within the story universe, he was actually part of the Grantville Army detachment that was at Magdeburg when Otto Guericke, the mayor of Magdeburg, decided he needed the city watch to become more of a real police department. So he asked for a couple of guys to help shape that, and Byron was one of the two uptimers that were pulled out of the Army detachment and seconded to the city police force to help shape them into a modern police force. Well, like anything where, you know, you bring in somebody from outside, there's going to be resistance. So Byron asked for somebody to be named to be his partner to work with him. And Gotthilf was the youngest member of the city watch at the time, so he got designated. And there's a certain amount of, you read the first story, there's a certain amount of resentment about that. But they get put together, and by the end of the first story, they actually develop a real partnership, and they go from there. They build on that initial relationship, and by the time of the novel, they're actually working together pretty well.
Yeah, they have a great sort of chemistry, and Byron he's sort of blue collar, and Hulk is he aristocrat or just really rich? Comes from a rich family.
His father was not an aristocrat or an adel or a hochadel. His father would have been called a member of the patrician class. So think of him as pretty wealthy by our standards, but not a member of the nobility.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Simon and Hans. Really the heart of the book for me, and the subplot that got to me emotionally time and again. I mean, here's this little crippled boy on the streets who, despite all he's going through, has a big heart, and this big bruiser. I mean, he's literally a bruiser. He's a professional fighter as well as working in a warehouse, who befriends him. It's kind of Dickensian. Can you talk about what brought these two together and how their story plays into the murder mystery?
When Eric and I talked about writing the novel, I had just finished writing a novelette involving Byron and Gotthilf and setting the original versions of the characters of Simon and Hans in that novelette. And I sent it to him, and I said, how about we use this as one of the threads for the novel? And he said, sure. Eric's pretty agreeable if it means he doesn't have to do a lot of extra work.
How did you work out the mystery? Did you talk it out, or did it come out of as you wrote the story? Or
most of the mystery was contained within that novelette. I mean, we had to enhance it. We had to make it more complex than it was in the novelette. But the basic framework of the whole mystery thread of the novel was contained in that novelette. So Simon and Hans, you'll find, when you read my stuff, you'll find time and again, you'll find a character with a physical handicap. And I do that for two reasons. I do that, first of all, because that was a hard time. It was not antiseptically clean and pure and, oh boy, everybody's well taken care of. That was a hard time for people. There would, the infant mortality rate was high, injuries were high, all of the disruption of warfare.
Magdeburg has gone through a horrible sacking not too long before this, correct? It's a
But what David's pointing to is I have in a different novel, I have one of my characters who was a farmer, reflecting on the fact that he's a soldier now, and that as a general rule, being a soldier was actually safer than being a farmer. It's actually still true today. People don't know this, but being a farmer is actually 7 times more dangerous than being a policeman. It's a very dangerous job because you're working with heavy equipment and you're on your own a lot. And that's true even today with modern medicine and all the rest of it. You can imagine what it was like. In those days, it was considered just normal. People didn't think about the fact that at least 30% of professional seamen lost their lives in the course of their careers just from doing their jobs. So just the level of risk and fatalities and casualties and injuries and disease and maiming was just an order of magnitude higher than it is in the modern world, at least in the advanced industrial world. And that's something that, you know, we try to reflect in the books. And I know when David came up with that character, Simon, my contribution there was I told him we'll start the book with Simon, which we did, because I knew right off that he was going to be the single character who the audience would immediately latch onto emotionally. Yeah, it's pretty hard not to. And then because of Simon so appealing, that would then make Hans an appealing character, which was dramatically the tricky proposition, because Hans is critical the whole story, but depending on how you look at him, he's not necessarily that nice a guy. So it's his friendship with Simon is sort of the prism through which the audience, the readers look at him, because that's how they get introduced to him, and that sort of automatically makes him, you know, a very likable figure to them. The thing I found, because I've never written a murder mystery before, is the tricky part about it is I found the way you draw readers into a story, especially a novel, is you have to present them with characters they really care about. And in the nature of things, murder mysteries can be hard that way because you're seeing people kind of at their worst. And the way that murder mystery writers usually handle that is their central character is the detective. But we could do that to some extent, particularly with Gotthilf, who's the more sort of dramatically central figure than his uptime partner, Byron. Byron is just kind of always there. He's sort of a fixed quantity. It's Gotthilf who evolves dramatically in the course of the story. It's writing that kind of story poses some interesting challenges, and being able to put Simon and Hans right in the center of the story and do it in the case of Simon, he's literally on page one, it was dramatically the key to making that book work, because you draw the reader in right away and there's always somebody that they care about, and every time Simon appears on stage he's likable, and he appears on stage a lot. And through him, so is Hans. And everything else revolves around that. The murder mystery, the singing, the political situation, everything else. But that's the dramatic core to the book. It's the reason why I think a novel does work really well, and that's the reason for it.
Yeah, the fight scenes are really good, too. And that's, I mean, you identify with Hans because he's you would like to be able to fight as well as he can when you're... And you can when you're inside of his point of view for a little bit. He's really good, right?
The key thing, the trickiest part there, and it came in more later, was keeping Hans just this side of being so brutal that the audience kind of shies away from him. But you do want him right at that edge, because partly just for the plot to work right, he's got to be a really, really tough guy. And it's not just tough in the ring fighting professionally, because later on, you know, his fights are not professional. They're real life and death fights out in the streets. And he's a savage street fighter as well as a fighter in the boxing ring. And making that work, we had to be careful. Actually, we had to do some rewriting because the first draft, he was a little too just savage. And we just realized this isn't going to work. It's going to just, you know, push people a little bit too far. So we had to back him off a little bit. But you didn't want to back him off too much because it's kind of part of the key to that character, who he is, and also is critical to the plot because if he wasn't that tough, that plot wouldn't work, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, well, he comes across to me as a good hard-boiled character who you can, it's a Hammett character, it's a Chandler character that you can, you understand that he's in a rough world, but he's also got a good heart. At least part of it has, at least part of it's good.
The way I like to think of it, he's got a very small heart, but but for those things he does love, he's very good about it. There's not a whole lot of people. Basically, it's his sister and Simon is what it comes down to. But he's true to that.
Where does do either one of you know a lot about boxing? Because there's a lot of boxing stuff in here that's really seems accurate and authentic.
I used to when I was in college. One of my best friends had been a professional boxer, and he used to take me down to the Olympic Auditorium, which was in those days the big auditorium downtown Los Angeles. That's why when I wrote 1632, I made Mike a professional boxer, and that's where he fought, was at the Olympic Auditorium. I've actually been there. And I knew a lot about it then. I followed it closely. This was a long time ago. We're talking about 40 years ago now, or longer than that. And my friend had been a professional boxer for a while. And so I did. I think in my case, though, and it's true with all, I have a lot of fight scenes in my novels because I write action novels, and including a lot of gunfights. Now, I've never been in a gunfight, and I've never known any gunfighters, so that's all made up. But I read a lot, and I pay attention to what I read. One of the things that I found is that people tend to have really wildly inaccurate concepts of what gunfights are really like. And part of what you have to do is really, basically what happens is that fictional gunfights and fights in general, but especially gunfights, are always way, way cleaner and neater and more choreographed than the real things are. A real gunfight is likely to look like they had one in Chicago about a year ago where a guy robbed the bank, came out of the bank, the alarm had gone off, three cops knew and actually had them cornered as soon as they came out of the bank, and they had their guns drawn. And he ordered them to drop his firearm, and he didn't. And a gunfight erupted. I don't think he actually fired any shots, or he did, beating anybody, but the policeman gunned him down, killed him. Nine bystanders were injured, wounded by gunfire, all of them by the police. All nine were shot by the cops. That's what real gunfights look like. Adrenaline gets pumping, people miss, they fire an enormous number of rounds without even realizing quite what they're doing. If you ever read accounts of the gunfight at the OK Corral, and that was a gunfight between very experienced gunfighters, and it was the same kind of chaotic situation. Well, you know, almost any kind of fights like that, and part of what makes professional boxers as good as they are is simply that they are trained over and over again to be able to keep their heads in a situation where most people can't. That's really the key to it. And that's what you see in Hans, is that part of he's very strong, you know, but it's also that he's very, in a sense, calm or cool-headed about when he's in a fight and he's watching for, you know, he knows what he's doing, he's doing it deliberately, which is what makes somebody a really dangerous fighter, because most people can't do it. They just can't. I mean, yeah, they're pumped full of adrenaline and they're, you know, basically they're just going through a fight-or-flight reaction without really being very conscious of much of anything. And that's why Hans is so dangerous, along with his strength. I mean, yeah, he's physically a very imposing person. So I think, I don't know if I'd say it's because I have boxing expertise, but David wrote all the first drafts and I touched them up, and the first drafts were good. So I don't know where David got it from, but
Basically, just from watching ESPN.
Okay.
I watched a lot of boxing and listened to the commentators and then just applied a little bit of common sense to it. But Eric's right about the characterization of Hans. The one thing I would add, he's a very self-confident man. He knows what he's capable of, and that gives him an edge over anybody else that he gets in the ring with.
Yeah, he's got a competence about him. It's not overconfidence. It's like I know I can do this, and he's very good at sort of the workmanship, the craftsmanship of beating the hell out of somebody. So are we going to see these two detectives in some? Have you written yourself out on these, David, or do you think we'll see some more of Hawken and Chieske?
As it turns out, I have written a novella that Eric has already tapped to put in the next Ring of Fire anthology. It will fit in between the three stories that are in 1635, Music and Murder, and the novel. So it fills in the time gap between the earlier stories and the novel. As far as future developments, well, that's kind of up to the muse. But Eric's already told me to start thinking in terms of what we do for an encore. So something will come up. These guys are not going to go away.
Would you say it's the novella? Is it the next anthology? Is that the ebook anthology or?
No. It's the next Ring. It'll be Ring of Fire 4. I have so far bought three. Well, one novel and two novellas for that book. One of the novellas is the one that David was just talking about. Kevin Evans has written a novella about the Pueblo Revolt and how it unfolds in this alternate universe. And Chuck Gannon's written a story that actually already appeared as on the website, Bane's website, but we're going to include that in the in Ring of Fire 4. And it'll be a while yet before the anthology comes out, but... that's a long, it's a, what is it, David? 24,000 words, I think, if I remember. No, that was,
It's about 33,000 words.
Yeah, it's longer than that. 24 is Kevin's story. Yeah, it's a full novella. I mean, it'll be the longest story. Well, except for mine, it'll be the longest story in that anthology when it comes out. And as for, I don't know if we'll do a sequel or not, as always, it depends on how well the book sells, but, and I have no real sense of how well Devil Opera is going to sell because it's as has been true of a lot of books in that series, they're not clones of each other. You know, these books can be very different from each other. And this is, again, something different. It's the scale of the action is smaller than most of them. It just takes place in one city, and it's at the heart of it, it's a murder mystery. So we'll just have to see how well the readers like it. If people like it enough, there's certainly more stories there.
Well, excellent. I think it's a heck of a novel, and it really hangs together as a novel. It's good. The book we're talking about is 1636, The Devil's Opera. Also available is David Carrico's excellent collection of related short stories and novellas, 1635, Music and Murder, which is available in ebook form at baneebooks.com and at online booksellers everywhere. So 1636, The Devil's Opera, is at booksellers everywhere now, and it's great and a moving read. I want to thank David Carrico and Eric Flint for being with us to talk about it. Thank you so much, David and Eric.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
And now we continue with our complete audiobook serialization of David Weber's Shadow of Freedom. This portion of Shadow of Freedom is provided by Audible.com. Get the complete audiobook at Audible.com now. If you are not a subscriber, you can get the entire audiobook free or choose from more than 100,000 other titles when you try Audible free for 30 days. Okay, here's what has gone before. After a fierce war, Honor Harrington's star empire of Manticore has reached a truce with a deadly menace, the ancient aristocratic Solarian League. The Solarian League is crumbling, and on the verge, the edge of its empire, rebellion is brewing. Royal Manticoran Navy Admiral Michelle Hinca, Countess Goldpeak, commands the Royal Manticoran Navy forces in the Talbot Quadrant, which is the region adjacent to the Verge and allied with the Star Empire. Though sympathetic to the rebels, Gold Peak must be careful where and when she commits the forces at her command. Stirring the pot is the shadowy Mason Alignment, a nasty group of eugenic supremacists plotting galactic domination using a genetically constructed super race. The Alignment plays a long game, but one of their goals is turning the Solarian League and the Star Empire of Manticore against each other in all-out war. For centuries, the Alignment has relied on secrecy and stealth to achieve its success, but lately agents of Haven and Torch have escaped with Mason defectors and are spreading the word about the Alignment's plans. The Alignment may soon be revealed for the conspiracy that it is, but the Mason Alignment isn't taking the challenge lying down. It plans to stop those agents in any way it can. Here is part 29 of David Weber's Shadow of Freedom.
Chapter 21. Well, this is an interesting development, Rear Admiral Michael Overstegen drawled. Michelle Henke restrained an urge to hit him over the head. It was difficult. I realize we aristocrats have a certain image to uphold, Michael, but is this really the best time to be displaying the depth of your sang-froid? Overstegen blinked, then gave himself a shake and actually smiled apologetically at her. Sorry about that, m'lady. Didn't even realize I was doing it. This time, anyway. He smiled again, more like his old self, and Michelle shook her own head. Glory be, something's finally knocked Michael's aristocratic, nothing-surprises-me superiority on its ass. Too bad it took something like this to do it. To be fair, m'lady, I don't think Admiral Overstegen's the only person this has taken by surprise, let's say, Cynthia Lecter observed. It's going to take some getting used to. Really? Michelle cocked her head and pursed her lips judiciously. Let's see. President Pritchard just decided to turn up in Manticore last month and offer a peace treaty, followed by the offer of a military alliance, and it turns out the reason for this is that according to Anton Zilwicki and the notorious Victor Cachot, something called the Mason Alignment has been plotting against both the Star Kingdom and Haven, among other people, for the last 5 or 6 T-centuries. You think we're not going to be able to take those minor changes in stride, Cindy? Excuse me, m'lady, but what was that you were just saying about aristocratic sang-froid? Overstegen inquired. Point, Michelle admitted. On the other hand, I'm the admiral and you're the rear admiral. Rank hath its privileges, or so I've heard anyway.
Actually, the thing I'm wondering is how accurate this intelligence really is, ma'am,
Sir Ivars Terakov said. All eyes turned towards him, and he shrugged.
I'm not saying I don't believe it. For one thing, it makes a whole lot of things that have been happening out here suddenly fit together a lot more neatly. My only concern is that it may make them fit together too neatly. Well, that and the fact that we don't really know anything at all.
As usual, Michelle reflected, Terakov had a damned good point. She tipped back in her own chair, contemplating the deckhead. The fact that 10th Fleet was only now learning about what was almost certainly the most momentous political development in the entire history of the Star Empire, or Star Kingdom of Manticore, was a stark comment on the information lags built into interstellar distances, and that was with the Lynx Terminus factored into the equation. The dispatch from Baroness Medusa and Admiral Kumalo had arrived here in the Montana system less than 6 hours ago. The duplicate dispatch to Vice Admiral Theodore Bennington, commanding the other half of 10th Fleet's heavy units at Tillerman, wouldn't reach its destination for another 10 T-days or so. It was obvious Medusa and Kumalo had wanted to get the initial flash message to her and Bennington as quickly as possible, and she could understand that. All the same, she could also wish they'd waited long enough to get at least a few additional details before banging it off to her. I admit it would be nice to have at least some idea what kind of treaty proposals Pritchard has in mind, she said after a moment. And I suppose I really would like a little more detail than Captain Zilwicky, ballroom buddy and general all-round manpower-hater extraordinaire, and his friend Victor Cashot, well-known Havenite spy, assassin, godfather to Torch, and saboteur of our alliance with Erewhon, both promise Mesa is really at the bottom of all this. But I think we have to take it as a given, for now at least, that they're basically telling the truth, Ivars. Ariel and Nimitz would know if someone was lying, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume the Empress wouldn't be taking a Havenite's word for anything without one hell of a lot of corroboration from someone she totally trusts. These people may be wrong, but they're not lying.
I didn't mean to suggest they were, ma'am,
Tarakov replied.
I'm just wondering how much responding to this we want to do before we get some kind of amplification.
That's a very sensible question, m'lady, Vice Admiral Aplilonia Munming said. Like Overstegen, the tallish, brown-haired, brown-eyed admiral was a native of the Star Empire's capital planet, but her accent was about as far removed from Overstegen's aristocratic drawl as a Manticoran accent could be. She was not only of lower-class origin, but of immigrant lower-class origin. Her family had fled the People's Republic of Haven 82 years before, and as proud of her commoner birth as Klaus Hauptmann himself. Despite which, she and Overstegen got along well. She was also the commander of Battle Squadron 16, the super-dreadnought core of the force Michelle had led to Montana as part of her redeployment plan.
This is something we're going to have to factor into all our planning, Munming went on. But until we have more information, we're going to have to be very cautious about how we factor it in, I think.
Oh, I agree entirely, Aplilonia. Michelle nodded vigorously. Still, in a lot of ways, it only underscores a lot of our existing contingency thinking where Mesa was concerned. We've all been worried about them ever since their proxies ran into Ivars at Monica. The main change I think we need to make in our thinking is that if this dispatch is accurate, if the Masons put together the Yawata strike out of their own resources, they've got one hell of a lot more organic combat strength than we've thought. Frankly, most of my thinking where they're concerned has been concentrated on the possibility of their using more Sally proxies, and I think that's probably true for pretty much all of us. If they're the ones who have the invisible starship drives, and they're willing to come out into the open, they could be a lot more dangerous, a lot more immediately dangerous, I mean, than we've allowed for. I'm sure there'll be a lot of other changes once we get Sir Ivar's amplification, but that's going to have to wait until additional information actually gets to us.
Another question, if I may,
Overstegen said. Go, Michelle replied, and he shrugged.
Another thought that's occurred to me is to wonder just how far we might want to disseminate this information at this point, ma'am.
According to the header on the dispatch, sir, Lecter said before Michelle could reply, this same basic message was sent to the chief executive of every system government in the quadrant, including President Suttles.
Makes sense, I suppose, Overstegen said.
Did the governor attach a specific security level to the information, Captain? It's classified top secret, but there's nothing in the classification to preclude someone like President Suttles sharing the information with any member of his system government. Obviously, Baroness Medusa and Prime Minister Alcazar expect them to show discretion, but they are the local civilian authorities, so I don't really see how she could have restricted it any more tightly than that, sir.
From Overstegen's expression, it was evident he could have imagined Medusa and Alcazar clamping an airtight lid on something like this quite easily. And for once, a part of Michelle found itself in grudging agreement with him. Still,
I don't think they really had a lot of choice about that, she observed.
If there's anything to this Mason alignment business, then everyone's got to be on her guard. My feeling is that we took them so badly by surprise with our original expansion into the vicinity
that they're probably still playing catch-up, at least to some extent. I mean, not even a diabolical centuries-old conspiracy could have anticipated our stumbling across the Link's terminus, and I don't think it could have had anything to do with Duenas' little brainstorm and saltash, either. You've all read Zavala's report, and I don't see how anybody could have counted on him to decide to seize our merchant ships. Several heads nodded. Desron 301 had rejoined 10th Fleet at Montana a month ago, and if one or two of Michelle's more senior officers could have wished for a less spectacular resolution of the problem, none of them had questioned Zavala's actions given the situation he'd discovered. But if Pat Givens' guess is right, Michelle continued, one index finger tapping the message on the display in front of her, and they not only managed to get Bing and Crandall deployed out this way more or less on the fly, and meant for both of them to get reamed all along, just to put us exactly where we are with the League, then they're entirely too good for my peace of mind. We need all the eyes we can get looking for what else they may be up to.
As long as those eyes don't start seeing things that aren't actually there, ma'am,
Overstegen replied with an unusual note of diffidence. He raised one hand in a pacific gesture before anyone could respond.
I'm not trying to suggest that the Quadrant's civilian leadership's a batch of alarmist paranoiacs, because I don't think it is. And if anyone does think he's seen anything that could be this Mason alignment's doing, then I hope to hell he tells someone about it. But we've got a very finite amount of naval and military strength here in Talbot. We can't afford to waste any of it on something that turns out not to have been hostile action, after all.
Agreed. Michelle nodded. Trust me, Michael, as the person whose resources are very finite, that's not something I'm likely to forget. All the same, I think we probably need our cat whiskers spread as far and as sensitively as we can get them. It's even more important to be sure we don't miss something that does turn out to have been hostile action, and we're just going to have to hope our filtering and evaluation are up to discriminating between real threats and false alarms. Overstegen nodded back soberly.
One thing I'd like to do, ma'am, Munming said, is to spend some time brainstorming. I know I just said we ought to be cautious about how we factor this into our planning, but I don't think it would hurt a thing for us to start considering what we might do if we were Mesa, and it turns out this information about the alignment is accurate after all. Let's kick out some possibilities. Think about worst-case scenarios they might spring on us, and start thinking of ways we might deal with them.
I'm in favor of that, ma'am, Overstegen agreed, nodding vigorously. The only resource that's likely to use up is brain power, which just happens to be one of the few resources I'm familiar with that only reproduces itself the more you use it.
Well, in that case, Michelle replied, does anyone have any worst cases they'd care to throw out before the meeting?
I wish I was more confident this was a good idea,
Sector Governor Verrocchio admitted quietly as he stood on the reviewing stand beside Junyang Hongbo. Hongbo refrained from pointing out that he'd raised that same point when the deployment was first suggested.
It's too late to change our minds anyway, he thought.
Besides, I'm not sure Usul didn't actually have a point this time.
It'd be a first, but even unlikely things happen sometimes.
The black-uniformed gendarmerie battalions marched past the reviewing stand, body armor gleaming like polished ebony, shouldered flechette guns sloped at precisely the right angle, boot heels crashing on the ceramicrete pavement in perfect unison. They actually looked like soldiers, Hongbo thought. For that matter, whatever her other failings, and God knew they were legion, Francisca Usul genuinely had instilled a level of discipline and training that was unfortunately rare among Salarian gendarmes. He never doubted that the megalomaniac in her loved watching them train, sort of like a little girl playing with toys she knew could kill people. That didn't mean she hadn't turned them into a far more effective unit along the way, however, and this business of passing in review before the sector governor had been her idea as well, a way to help promote and support their morale, their esprit de corps, as she put it.
Esprit de corps, right.
He snorted mentally.
Bunch of thugs and leg breakers is what they are. Dispatch just happens to be even better at it than most of the others.
Yet that was precisely what Frontier Security had always wanted when it came down to it. He knew that as well as Yusel did, but unlike her, he wasn't convinced it was a good idea, especially in this case. Turning them loose with what amounted to a free license to break heads, or worse, especially in a theoretically independent star system, struck him as an excellent recipe for increasing unrest and hatred in the Protectorates.
And it's not as if we don't have enough of that to go around already.
He listened to the steady beat of boot heels and cursed himself for having crawled into bed with Mesa and Manpower all those years ago. It shouldn't be this way. It was only supposed to be another of the comfortable little arrangements OFS officials formed all the time. But this arrangement was different. Unlike anyone else in the Madras Sector Administration, he knew Manticore was right about the Masons' involvement in both New Tuscany and Crandall's attack on Spindle, because they'd used him to help set those events in motion, and he wondered what snake was going to crawl out from under a rock next. As he watched the pair of intervention battalions marching past the reviewing stand, a cold, hard lump in his chest suggested he might just be looking at that next serpent. Lorcan Verrocchio was unaware of what his vice commissioner was thinking, but Junyan Hongbo might have been surprised by how his nominal superior's thoughts paralleled his own. Verrocchio wished passionately that he hadn't let Yusel talk him into authorizing this deployment, and he wished even more passionately that she wasn't commanding it in person. But she'd talked him into that too, and it was too late to change his mind now.
"You said you wanted this whole thing settled fast," he reminded himself. "And she's got a point. No one else in the sector could settle something like this as quickly as she will. The only question is how many eggs she's ready to break for her omelet."
That worried him, because he suspected the answer was a lot, and that could be disastrous with all the attention being focused on the Madras sector and the Mantis Talbot quadrant. God only knew what some bleeding-heart inner-world newsie might do with an expose of OFS brutality out in the Protectorates. In fact, the mere thought of what someone like Audrey O'Hanrahan would do with Yusel's idea of the best way to deal with restive populations was enough to tie Lorcan Verrocchio's stomach in knots.
"But what else can I do? I need to get in and out of Mobius, and I need to do it before the situation gets any worse. So far, nobody outside the sector even seems to have noticed, probably because they're all so busy watching to see what happens between Manticore and the Navy. But if it drags on, if it gets even worse, somebody will pick up on it. After all, this is where the entire confrontation started, isn't it? Of course, the bastards in the media are keeping an eye peeled this way, so if I don't keep the lid screwed down, GHQ is going to have my ass because another spectacular fiasco in sector, or anywhere remotely near it for that matter, is sure to draw the newsies' attention. That's the last thing the Home Office wants, except some equally spectacular allegation of excessive force or gendarme brutality."
He kept his shoulders back, maintaining a properly attentive, nobly determined expression for the troops' benefit, but even this review could turn out as a public relations disaster. If the men and women marching past him in their black uniforms and shiny boots turned in the sort of performance intervention battalions had turned in so often before, and the newsies did get wind of it, the fact that he'd sent them off with such public fanfare and obvious approval was only going to make things even worse.
"It's all the damned Mantis' fault," he thought bitterly. "Until they shoved their noses into Talbot, who the hell cared what happened out here in the armpit of the galaxy? Nobody, that's who. Now anything that happens has the potential to be another interstellar incident."
He glanced at Hongbo, standing beside him with an equally grave expression. The vice commissioner had covered his own ass quite neatly, Verrocchio reflected resentfully. He was on record as opposing the deployment, of having come around to it only reluctantly, only because all of Verrocchio's security advisors had endorsed it. So if it all blew up in Verrocchio's face, Hongbo could always point out that he'd been opposed to it from the beginning, and if it worked, he got credit for having been open-minded and thoughtful enough to put aside his initial opposition when those security advisors' reasoned arguments convinced him they had a point. The universe, Lorcan Verrocchio concluded resentfully, wasn't exactly brimming over with fairness.
That was David Weber's Shadow of Freedom, Part 29, read by Allison Johnson. Well, the fat lady has sung for this podcast. Thanks to Audible.com, thanks to Hank Davis, Christopher Cifani, and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And a semi-cacophonous aria of bravos, huzzas, and hell yeahs rising to operatic proportions for 1636 The Devil's Opera, co-authors Eric Flint and David Carrico. Please join us next time here at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy. Keep reaching for the stars.